on the record.
Our next witness will be Mr. Michael Rossetti, unless there's any preliminary matters before we start. Mr. Rossetti, if you'd step toward the stand and raise your right hand, do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated. And you're not represented by counsel, Mr. Rossetti.
I am not.
I believe you prepared direct testimony, rebuttal testimony, and surrebuttal testimony that have been previously filed with the commission. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
And the direct testimony dated May 21st, 2014 has already been received in the record. But did you also prepare the testimony entitled rebuttal testimony and filed June 26, 2014, and surrebuttal testimony filed July 17, 2014?
Yes, sir.
And these documents are in question and answer format. If you were to address the questions that are presented in both of these documents today, would your answers be the same as those that are reflected in these two documents?
Pretty much. I've learned a lot during the process of participating in this meeting or in the case, and there are some things that I didn't fully understand that I might have commented on in the original testimony having to do with cost causation that I didn't have full understanding about. So with that note, everything else I would say is yes.
And you're free at this time if you want to make any specific corrections to them, if you would like to.
I'm not prepared to do that.
Okay. So do you adopt these two documents as your testimony in this proceeding?
I do.
Together with the direct testimony that's already been received?
I do.
Okay. And would you begin by, again, offering us your full name, spell it for the record, the organization with which you're affiliated, any other brief background, and any brief summary of your testimony that you would like to make at this time?
Okay. My name is Michael D. Rossetti, R-O-S-S-E-T-T-I. I live at 13051 Shadowlands Lane. Shadowlands is one word, Draper, Utah, 84020. I am a professional software engineer, a computer scientist. I have a full-time position and have worked for some really fun companies over the years. Does that cover the basic questions, sir? Okay. Now, I did have a summary of my points, and I prepared a few visual assistants. Would it be okay to talk to those?
Is there an objection to that, to the use of flip chart? Mr. Moskin?
Conceptually, no, and we recognize and appreciate the deference the commission's already shown Mr. Rossetti, and we understand he's not an attorney. I guess I don't want to waive, having not seen them, I don't want to waive any objection if it goes beyond the scope, et cetera, but just conceptually, if it's used in a summary format, that's fine.
Right.
Okay. And if there's any concern, just give me a sign, and I'll flip to the next thing. I've tried to make sure that the things that I show in my little chart are directly related to testimony that's been filed by me or other parties.
They should summarize what you've presented. That's your purpose now.
Yes.
And to do that in a brief but reasonable amount of time.
Recognizing
we've all read your testimony and
right.
Okay.
My intention is just to add color of things that I've learned over the last few days, in fact. discovery that has been filed by the company subsequent to the surrebuttal, for example, as well, if that's okay. And
let's begin, and we'll see how it goes.
I'm nervous, so I'm going to read pretty much what I've got. Thanks to everyone. I know that your time is valuable, and I will try to keep my summary short. I do have several key points to make, colored by the things that I've experienced since yesterday morning. And I've learned a lot since yesterday. For instance, I didn't know I would be allowed to ask questions. The office was very generous in helping me understand procedural matters, at least up to the point where I expressed some disagreement with their rated capacity approach. So I was pretty ignorant about being able to ask questions yesterday. I would have been prepared to ask Mr. Walgie some questions, but I was still in shock that I was actually able to ask those questions. Well, that's water under the bridge, and I'm not going to answer those or get answers to those unasked questions. If I do step out of bounds, please let me know. I'll skip over the back-slapping self-introduction, but give a quick introduction to UCARE and not bore you with how we used our inheritance money to pay for our own particular solar project. Well, except for one small anecdote, and then get to the heart of the matter. Okay, skip self-introduction. UCARE is an informal, unfunded group of Utah citizens who believe, about 82 people, who believe individuals should have the right to choose the sources of their energy. Many have renewable energy, many have nothing, but they want the right to exercise that in the future without being penalized. Many simply believe that individuals should be able to do everything they can to reduce the nasty air we experience along the Wasatch Front. Many believe in self-reliance. Some are grandparents, some are young people, just starting their families, and like a 401k, investing in a cleaner, brighter future for their children. There are many reasons people have supported us at UCARE. However, no one at UCARE, in fact, no one with whom I've spoken who has solar, has been opposed to paying his or her fair share. But they all emphasize that the result must be fair to all parties involved. In this case, residential customers and residential customers who net meter. We are not basing any of our arguments on emotional gradualism, but on facts, and we're hoping we understand the facts. So the anecdote, one of the questions we were asked by a neighbor after he put in our solar system is, what is the ROI on your system? My wife responded with a question, what was the ROI on that home theater system you just put in? The point is, we did it for many reasons, not just because of potential ROI. That was part of it. So let me summarize our main concerns about the proposed net metering fee. There are at least four significant flaws in the current proposal. First, the primary foundational number used to calculate the proposed aggregate fee is inappropriate. I will demonstrate that in a minute. Second, the fee calculation is based on a flawed perceived system usage, which does not actually match real system usage. My terms might not match what goes along in the industry, but hopefully as we talk about it in my testimony that I filed, that there will be understanding. Third, there are claims of wear and tear and required system modifications for which no evidence have been provided. And fourth, any benefits of residential renewable energy have been dismissed out of hand, while UCARE and others have shown that there is an actual financial benefit to the company that has not been taken into consideration, as well as energy savings benefits. Beyond the flaws, we've also shown that any kind of flat fee is inequitable and that a capacity-based fee is no better in the fairness department. And finally, we have shown that the current level of net metering does not warrant a hasty and prudent decision. I need to apologize for the confusion I caused yesterday in my written testimony and in my written testimony by the use of the term gross consumption. I knew that RMP did not generally know what a net metering customer's total electricity consumption was. So I was assuming that from their and everyone's point of view, gross would mean the total amount of electricity flowing into the residents from the grid as measured by the meter. And now that I've got that apology off my chest, I will continue to use that term during my summary comments. So let's, if I may use my little chart here. This is,
Mr. Rossetti, could you move that closer to us? I want to get you as close to the reporter as I can, so I'm sure that he can hear you. And council will also need, well, but you'll need to point it so that council can see it.
Is this good?
That will be good for them.
I'll do some rotation. Okay, this is Ms. Stewart's spreadsheet, unchanged. Okay. So let's take a quick look. We'll get it. Don't worry.
While he's setting that up, Commissioner Clark, could I again interject and say we're very happy with the deference the commission's given, but to the extent this is going to evolve from a summary of testimony to a presentation critiquing the testimony of others, I guess I'd just like to, you know, raise an objection that that is not the point of a summary, as we've, you know, kind of already discussed today. And so we're now moving to exhibits from other people's testimony that I believe we're going to hear a critique of. So I think we're just starting to stray a little bit from the purpose. And I again, recognize it's a different circumstance. I just don't want to waive that objection.
Mm-hmm. The point of, Mr. Rossetti, of the pre-filing of testimony is so the council can prepare to cross-examine, the process allows each witness to present all of their views and opinions and supporting material, again, so that council can prepare. And so if this is going to be a new analysis that isn't in your testimony.
Oh, it is in my testimony.
Then that will be fine if you can do this in a brief way. But I just want to make sure you understand Mr. Moskin's concern that if we start into new areas of opinion or of purported factual support for your opinions, then there probably is a different way for you to approach the commission with this information.
Okay. This is based on existing testimony that I've written in my survey rebuttal, and you know.
Okay.
So I'll make the key point here, and then
sure.
I'll look and see if you still.
Please go forward.
Right. So this whole analysis is based, everything on which this case is based depends on this number right here. Line 11, net metering kilowatt hours, 13,012,995. And I had been, I'm going to go off record or off my notes here. I had been under the assumption this entire time that number represented the excess kilowatt hours recorded by the meter, the energy flowing out of the house into the grid. What that number actually is the number of kilowatt hours flowing into the house from the grid. So it's the total aggregate number provided by the utility. So the application of this 2.6 cents across that entire number means, and let's make sure I have it, I say it properly. It means that they are being billed this 2.6 cents for every single kilowatt hour that they have consumed, except for the net. Including the netted electricity if this passes, which means that depending on their consumption, if they consumed 1,500 kilowatt hours in a month and only generated 200,000 kilowatt hours of excess, they would have been billed for about 1,200 kilowatt hours, which means they would have paid 2.6 cents on the 14-19 over the month, and that's not right. I'm getting off my script here, but that was the key point I wanted to make, that this number here is the wrong number to be used. And I'll summarize it up. I'll skip everything in here because we want to be brief. The bottom line is we need a better calculation, and we haven't done our homework. The calculations should be based upon the gross amount that the consumer has used from the utility and the net amount that they've put back into the system. Compared to other residential customers, this would be my proposal, is that they be billed for the difference. So if, in addition, okay, so if they used 1,419 kilowatt hours in a month, that mean, and they only generated 200,000 kilowatt or 200 kilowatt hours in the month, then that 200 kilowatt hours in the month is the thing that represents the difference, the part they're not paying, instead of the whole 1,419. That's the fundamental issue here, and that's why I think that number on that spreadsheet, and that is my key point. So I'll skip to the end because that was the key point. And I won't bother you with any other charge. Should I wait? Oh, yes, I'm sorry. I do need to show one other chart. You will recognize this as the chart that shows how solar does not match the peak residential consumption. We maintain that there is a financial benefit to the company in the integration of this area of the graph where the two intersect, because when solar is generating electricity excess at this point, the company is offsetting more expensive energy. Now, I don't know how much that is, but I do know it's not insignificant. I actually prepared a chart showing an actual example, but since that's not in the testimony, I'll leave it alone. One final point, if you will, and then I'll be done. May I ask my administrative assistant to come up?
Sure.
And then I will be done.
Sure.
This is a graph. This is a graph of the 3 billion kilowatt hours of energy that have been consumed in the test period from the company ending June 2013. This represents that amount of energy that was consumed by residential customers.
So for the record, you have a red ribbon.
A red ribbon
extends
20 feet long.
20 feet between you and your assistant.
Yes. And the green on this graph represents the quarter inch of net generating excess electricity that was produced during that same period of time, including the 30% growth that occurred since then. Okay, so this is just a representation to show how significant net metering is and why I believe we ought not to be premature in making a decision without considering issues like this. Thank you. With that, I'll terminate myself.
Please don't do that, but I think we all object to that, but
you,
terminate the summary, and you'll now be available for cross-examination as soon as you are comfortably seated again in the witness stand. So,
Mr. Rossetti, I actually may not even have any questions, but I want to clarify just to make sure I understood what you said. On the first chart, when you circled the 13012995 number, what did you indicate that your understanding was that you learned that you finally learned what that was?
See if I can find that in my SIR rebuttal. In one of our discovery requests, we asked for clarification on that number. And it will just take me a second. And I may have to look in the discovery itself.
We'll be off the record.
No, I should have been ready for that. Sorry.
It's all right. I'm just wondering if you recall. Oh, sorry.
I can't find it in my SIR rebuttal, but it was part of a discovery request.
Okay. So we're on the record.
Okay. My question is, I thought I heard you state that that was the number that represented the total amount of energy that went back or forth through the system. So I'm just wondering if you recall what you said you believe, what you said it was.
Okay, I originally believed naively that that number represented the excess generation by solar customers or renewable energy customers. But I was corrected in one of the rebuttals, one of your rebuttals, telling me that that was not actually what the number was. The number was actually the what I call gross consumption. In other words, the complete kilowatt hours of energy by the customer, not the netted amount of energy.
Okay.
You want me to find that?
I guess if I might approach.
Yes.
Just to clarify then. Handing you page 18, since you don't have with you, from the rebuttal of Joel Stewart, line 351 to 352.
Yes.
If you can just read that for us.
Okay. This was a question having to do with identifying errors in our analysis and assertions. The answer. You want just the underlined part? Okay. JRS-8, comma, is not excess electricity produced by net metering customers, semicolon. Instead, comma, 13,012,995 kilowatt hours is the annual net billed usage by net metering customers.
So it referred to the net, not the gross.
Net billed usage.
And I guess then the last question I'd ask you is on the ribbon demonstration where you had the quarter inch, are you aware that the existing commission order allows for how much of that ribbon could be consumed by net metering?
I've heard a figure, I think it was, 3% or 15%? I don't recall. That's not my area.
All right. Thank you. No other questions.
Jetter.
No questions from the division. Thank you.
Mr. Coleman.
As an initial point, the office appreciates the commission's indulgence in assisting Mr. Rossetti, given some of the concerns that we had with respect to our positions. And with that, the office has no questions for Mr. Rossetti.
Thank you. Mr. Cully or Mr. Plank?
We have no questions, Your Honor.
That concludes your testimony, Mr. Rossetti. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're excused.
Commissioner Clark, are you ready to proceed with Mr. Mixes?
We are. Thank you.
We, TASS would call Nathaniel Mixes to the stand, please. And he does need to be sworn.
Thank you. Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth? Thank you. Please be seated.
Mr. Mixes, would you please state your name, position, and business address?
Sure. My name is Nathaniel Mixes. Last name is spelled M-I-K-S-I-S. I'm a consultant with Keyes, Fox, and Weidman, LLP. Business address is 436 14th Street, Suite 1305 in Oakland, California.
In connection with this case, did you prepare rebuttal testimony and serve rebuttal testimony that's been pre-filed with the commission?
Yes, I did.
Do you have any changes or corrections that need to be made to that testimony?
Yes, I do.
Would you please go ahead and tell us what those are?
I have a few minor edits to my surrebuttal, which were submitted as errata, I believe.
So let me indicate, Commissioner Clark, I provided the court reporter with the changes that Mr. Mixes is about to indicate. They appear on two pages of his testimony, and they're brief, so I believe the parties will be able to pick them up as he indicates them from the stand.
Thank you.
If you prefer a different method, we could certainly do that.
That's just fine.
Thank you. Go ahead with the corrections, Mr. Mixes.
Okay. On surrebuttal, page 17, line 7, the testimony read reduction in contribution to CP, which is coincident peak. That was replaced with distribution system peak. On line 9, I had...
Could you...
Oh, I'm sorry.
Just give us a moment to make those in our
Absolutely.
Copies.
Mr. Mixes, why don't you go ahead and repeat that first one just to make sure everybody understood it.
Sure. Page 17 of my surrebuttal, line 7, I deleted the abbreviation CP and replaced it with the three words distribution system peak.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to the next correction.
Okay. Same page, line 9, replaced CP with distribution system peak, or rather replaced system CP with distribution system peak.
And that shows on line 8 for my in my copy, I believe. So.
I'm sorry?
I said that shows on line 8 in my okay. copy, just for the record.
Okay.
I think I'm at the right place, but...
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I make a suggestion that just read the complete sentence in which that applies, and then we'll make sure we're all on the right spot?
Sure.
Thank you.
All right. I'll begin on what I have as line 6. It says, in Ms. Stewart's example, it appears that rooftop solar has a greater reduction in contribution to distribution system peak, and that the customer with rooftop solar contributes only about 60% of the residential class average to distribution system peak. Does that work?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mixes. Let's go to the next change or correction on that same page.
Okay.
And again, perhaps we could first identify the specific words changed and then have you read the whole sentence as Mr. Jetter suggested.
Sure. What I have as line 17 deleted was CP. The correct sentence is, if the impact of NEM on a customer's contribution to distribution peak.
Mr. Why don't you go ahead and reread that sentence with the correction in it now?
Yes. If the impact of NEM on a customer's contribution to distribution peak were equal to that from EE, the NEM charge would constitute disparate treatment of similarly situated customers.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to the next change, please.
The next change, the sentence begins with, as it stands, the customers aren't similarly situated. NEM customers appear, from Ms. Stewart's diagrams, to have a contribution to system CP that is even lower than EE customers, making the NEM charge constitute both disparate and punitive treatment. The corrected sentence is, I'll start with NEM customers. NEM customers appear, from Ms. Stewart's diagrams, to have a contribution to distribution system peak that is even lower than EE customers, making the NEM charge constitute both disparate and punitive treatment.
Thank you.
Okay, and do we have another another page with changes?
Yes, page 22.
Again, perhaps if you could tell us the specific change and then read the sentence with the correction included.
Okay. the original sentence begins the first word of the first line, contribution to system coincident peak, or CP, than a non-solar DG customer. The correction is contribution to distribution system peak than a non-solar customer.
So you're deleting the words coincident peak and the paren CP, correct?
That's correct.
And the next correction?
Next correction is line 2, same page. Because CP is used in cost of service to allocate fixed costs, I'll end there for now. The correction is because contribution to peak is used in cost of service to allocate fixed costs.
You okay. Have that? Okay. And is there one more correction, Mr. Mixes?
Yes, there is.
Where's that?
The end of the sentence, I'll begin with a reasonable interpretation is that a customer with this pattern of usage and a 3.2 kilowatt solar DG system bears only 60% of class average responsibility for fixed generation and transmission costs.
And what's the change?
The change is replacing the last four words, generation and transmission costs, with distribution costs and perhaps other fixed costs as well.
And Mr. Mixes, with those changes and corrections, does the SIR rebuttal testimony and the rebuttal testimony reflect what your testimony would be if you were asked and answered those, if you were asked those questions today?
Yes.
Would move the admission of Mr. Mixes' rebuttal testimony and SIR rebuttal testimony with the corrections he's indicated.
Any objections? They're received.
Mr. Mixes, have you prepared a summary of your testimony to present today?
Yes, I have.
Please go ahead with that summary.
good afternoon, commissioners. Good afternoon, everybody. I appreciate the opportunity to participate in this proceeding. My summary testimony covers several key topics for the commission to consider in their decision on Rocky Mountain Power's proposed net metering facilities charge. Let me begin by saying that the primary argument in favor of this charge is that a cost shift occurs between net metering and non-net metering customers. Pardon me. This argument has two foundations. First, that net metering customers have adverse operational and cost impacts on the power grid, And second, that net metering customers continue to have residential class average responsibility for fixed costs, while they have less than residential average contribution to these costs through variable energy purchases. Am I reading at an okay pace? A little slower, okay. The operational and cost impacts have not been proven in the record, and in fact, several assertions made by the company have been unsupported or contradicted by the company's responses to data requests. The second foundation, in the simplest terms, is that net metering customers continue to use the company's infrastructure, and particularly the distribution system. This is, of course, true at the present time, but it's not a binary use or no use issue. Cost allocation methods approved in cost of service proceedings allocate responsibility for fixed costs through several metrics that vary widely among individual residential customers and groups of residential customers. The metrics most applicable to this case are contribution to system coincident peak, distribution system peak, and non-coincident peak, all of which are affected by on-site solar generation, and for all of which the data record is sparse. What evidence has been presented, for example, by witnesses Stewart and Marks, shows an approximate 40% reduction in contribution to distribution system peak and a minimum of 7% contribution to circuit peak, respectively. I say a minimum of 7% because the level of analysis is properly at the customer level and not the neighborhood level in Salt Lake City, covered by the Northeast substation analysis, since we are talking about a customer charge and not a neighborhood charge. If even a small fraction of rooftops in the study did not receive a solar installation, the remaining that did would have a greater than 7% reduction in their own contribution to circuit peak. The most appropriate evidence we have is Stewart's diagram A in her rebuttal, which shows an approximate 40% reduction in contribution to distribution peak, though a smaller, perhaps 4% reduction in non-coincident peak, compared with an average customer. The 40% reduction is applicable to distribution-related fixed costs, and in quotes, distribution substation, distribution PNC, protection and control, and distribution transformer, which together comprise approximately $17.37 of the $24.19 in distribution and retail-related costs the company is asserting the residential class average customer is responsible for. 40% of $17.37 is $6.95, which exceeds the company's requested NEM facilities charge. Admittedly, the record is sparse, and this 40% reduction is one data point. Another is 7%. But these values derive from their respective peak hours, distribution level in the first case and circuit peak in the second, of 6 p.m. and 7 p.m., respectively. As was demonstrated yesterday, various peak hours for system coincident peak, distribution peak, and circuit peak can occur as early as 3 p.m. The earlier in the day the peak occurs, other things equal, the greater the reduction in peak contribution of NEM customers. I will now turn to my summary of my submitted testimony, if that is okay with the commission. In my direct testimony on behalf of TASC, I raised two primary points regarding the company's justification for the net metering charge. First, I asserted that the company did not provide evidence supporting their assertion that net metering customers contributed less than their fair share to fixed cost recovery. And second, I disputed the company's statement that net metering customers had harmful or costly impacts on the grid or on other customers. In rebuttal, the company continued to assert that net metering customers avoided their fair contribution to fixed costs, introducing as evidence a diagram showing an imperfect match between peak solar production and peak distribution system demand, and citing cost of service cost allocation methods. I have citations, but I don't think I need to, unless you would like them. The company also introduced testimony from a witness who made statements shown later to be either unsupported or contradicted by the record, and alleged that an experience of a company affiliate with large solar plants causing operational problems in Oregon was relevant to discussion of small residential scale solar installations in Utah. Additionally, The company in rebuttal also referred to a separate commission proceeding referred to as the Qualifying Facilities, or QF, docket, in which an avoided cost value for utility-scale solar was calculated, asserting that this avoided cost was directly applicable to the benefits calculation of distributed solar. In rebuttal, witness, I apologize, Farniars, for the Division of Public Utilities indicated that Utah Clean Energy witness Gilliam and Sierra Club witness Mulvaney did not make conclusive cases in their respective testimonies that the benefits of net metering clearly outweighed the costs for residential customers. Okay. In my surrebuttal, I addressed the points made by the company and witness Farniars, holding that the record remained insufficient to justify the proposed net metering charge. In response to witness Stewart's assertion that net metering customers do not fully pay for the costs that their usage imposes on the distribution system, I maintained that the record did not support her assertion. I highlighted how the company's own diagram, which showed the modeled impact of a solar installation on a residential customer's net energy demand, actually shows an apparent reduction in the customer's contribution to distribution peak of approximately 40%. I also mentioned how the company was unable to provide TASC with data on actual net metering customers' load curves in order to establish actual contribution to system peak, distribution peak, and non-coincident peak, which would be necessary to positively show that net metering customers were avoiding their responsibility for generation, transmission, and distribution system costs through lower energy sales. In response to witness Marx's testimony that RMP affiliate Pacific Power had incurred costs to replace transformers in order to accommodate net metering customers, I highlighted that the company's data response contradicted the statement. In response to witness Marx's anecdote about operational issues affecting customers resulting from incorrect operation of equipment at two large solar plants in Oregon, I cited TASC's data request for information on operational issues in RMP's Utah territory about which customers had complained. The company had responded that they were unable to determine whether these complaints were attributable to distributed solar installations. Additionally, it is important to note that the large solar plants mentioned are on the order of 100 to 200 times larger than typical residential distributed generation systems. In response to witness Marx's explanation of a situation in which DG could cause an overvoltage condition, I cited the company's response to TASC's data request on any events like these in which DG exceeded load on a circuit actually occurring in RMP test territory. The response was that this had not occurred to the best of its knowledge. In response to company witnesses Walji and Duvall asserting that the QF dockets shows that net metering customers receive compensation well above the value of PV solar, quote unquote, I highlighted three major problems with this comparison. First, the QF docket utility scale solar PV avoided cost does not account for costs avoided by having DG meeting on-site load at a customer's home, such as transmission and distribution related costs, line losses, and geographic diversity. Second, the reference QF docket identified a transmission constraint that would affect the avoided energy and possibly capacity costs at different locations on RMP's system, but the study did not calculate locationally differentiated avoided costs, which would be relevant for solar DG on the import or load pocket side of the constraint. Third, the utility scale solar PV avoided cost in the QF docket was reduced by an integration cost, although integration costs were incurred to interconnect distributed generation, as I understand it, are the responsibility of the interconnecting customer, not the utility or other customers. In response to DPU witness Farniar's criticism that interveners had not made a conclusive case on net metering benefits exceeding net metering costs, I noted that my understanding, and I'm not a lawyer, is that witnesses for interveners opposing the company's proposal do not bear the burden to prove this case. The burden, I believe, rests with the party proposing the change, namely the company. I'm almost done. In testimony, I consistently maintain that the record does not support critical assertions made by the company to justify the net metering facility's charge. The assertions of negative impacts on the grid, the company, or on other customers caused by net metering customers is unsupported and in cases contradicted by the record. The remaining justification is related to allegations of a cost shift from net metering customers to non-net metering customers. At the highest level, the cost shift justification offered in support of the net metering facility's charge is based on cost causation, namely that net metering customers have unchanged peak use of the grid after installing solar. Because they reduce net consumption, it is true that net metering customers contribute less to fixed costs than they did before installing on-site generation. However, the second part of the cost causation argument, that overall consumption falls while peak use does not, is not shown by the record. In witness Stewart's rebuttal.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. I hate to interrupt you, but how much more do you have? It just seems like.
A page and a half.
Your Honor, it just appears that he's taking a lot more time.
It's a pretty extensive summary.
Okay.
But we're familiar with the testimony, so if you can keep your focus on what you think is most important for us to know.
Of course. I would like to make the point. That I already made. Okay. So my summary observations, if you'll indulge, shouldn't take too long.
I thought that was your summary. Apologize. Wasn't that your summary?
That was most of it.
And so you have a summary of your summary?
I have a bullet list of observations. I can skip to the last one if you don't mind.
Just give us what you think is most important for us to know, recognizing that we're acquainted with your pre-filed testimony.
Okay. In that case, I will say two things. I believe that with better data on actual load profiles and data on customers' net loads at the time coinciding with system and distribution circuit peaks, this issue may be settled one way or another, but for now it is not possible to show there's a cost shift. And finally, witness Stewart testifies that the company's load research study may include exploring development of a new rate schedule class that could involve three-part rates, including a fixed monthly charge. I believe you're familiar with that. I believe that an optional rate schedule of this type could align cost causation with cost recovery from many customers, including those with on-site generation. With sufficient data from the load research study in hand, a collaborative rate design initiative could potentially allow parties who disagree on the justification of the net metering charge to find common ground for developing fair and efficient residential rates for all residential customer types.
Thank you, Mr. Mixes. Mr. Mixes is now available for cross-examination.
Thank you.
Ms. Hogle.
Mr. Mixes, I believe in your summary you said that if a few more customers were on the Northeast substation attached to the Northeast substation, had rooftop solar, they would reduce peak by more than the 7%.
No, what I was referring to is in the study, as I understand it, the graph showing the 7% mm-hmm. was for the entire region served by that substation. Presumably, not every rooftop there has solar, and so those that do would have a higher than 7% reduction in contribution to the circuit peak.
Do you agree that doesn't the study assume that if all customers on the circuit who had rooftop solar, there could be a contribution to peak on that circuit of only 7% at peak, assuming the solar were operating optimally every day of the month? I mean, you're talking optimal conditions. every customer on that circuit?
I'm presuming that the total peak demand on the substation included customers with and without solar. Therefore, so I would consider that to be the denominator.
But do you agree that that's what the study assumed, the study presented by the company?
That every customer with a rooftop had rooftop solar.
And that the rooftop solar photovoltaic was generating at the optimal level. Solar PV.
Yeah, solar PV. Again, my presumption is that, yes, per the assumptions of the study, it is a best-case scenario. That said, if, for example, half of the, let's say, metered customers in that territory had roofs and half did not, those that did would have a greater than 7% reduction, because the 7% reduction, as I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is among all customers served by that substation, or sorry, by that circuit.
And would you agree that it would take a mandate for even half or all of these customers to install solar PV and for your results to show up, as you just state? I mean, it would have to be a situation where every customer would have PV solar, and that's an unrealistic assumption, correct?
I agree that it would take a mandate to require that level of installation. What I'm talking about is for those customers who do have solar, the ratio between their solar production and their peak load is higher than 7% of the 100% shown in the graph. If I'm not being clear, please say so.
Well, I'm just wondering if you're stating that based on facts. I mean,
I'm stating it based on a presumption that not every metered customer served by that substation had solar.
Thank you. Okay, I'm just going to ask you a couple more questions. In your direct testimony, and I don't know that you need to go there, but on page 15, you cite a recent study by Sandia National Laboratories, correct?
Yes.
And just to clarify, the study focused on a 2-megawatt utility-scaled system, not rooftop solar, correct?
I don't recall.
Your Honor, just a few seconds, please.
I believe my testimony does not say one way or the other.
Yes.
Can you read that into the record?
Ms. Hoggle, could you identify what we're looking at or what he's looking at for the record and for the rest of us, please?
It is in his direct testimony, page 15, and his citation to footnote 6.
And what are you showing him?
That is, I believe, does this look like the study that you were citing?
I believe this is the report.
You're showing him the study that he referred to. Okay, great. Thank you. I just couldn't see what you're showing.
Apologize. Would you mind?
Of course. a follow-up study was initiated in 2011, focusing on potential utility-scale PV deployment, specifically 2-megawatt nominal systems on a distribution feeder in Utah. So my interpretation would be it says utility scale, but it's also a distribution feeder.
Do you agree that rooftop solar customers completely rely on and use the company's distribution facilities and utilities at this point?
I would say at some times they rely completely, yes.
Okay, thank you. I have no further questions.
Mr. Jetter.
No questions from the division. Thank you.
Mr. Coleman?
I do have a few questions. One, Mr. Missis, one sort of preliminary issue. In your the resume that you attached to your direct testimony, in your selected experience, the first item reads, quote, drafted motion to intervene in opposition on behalf of the Alliance for Solar Choice in Colorado PUC dockets 14A-0301E and 14A-0302E. I have those documents, and you didn't sign them. You drafted them?
I did.
And then Ms. Smart assumed your discussion? Is that?
I believe so. I'll take your word for it.
You don't know if she signed it?
I believe she did.
Well, is that the end of that one, Mr. Coleman, or do I have to object?
I just curious. He represented, made a representation of his experience. I'm trying to better understand. In your direct testimony on page 11, you start with a discussion.
If you hold on 1 second.
Sure.
Which line are you referring to?
Page 11, line, well, it starts, your question and answer starts about line 6. And through this, to summarize the answer that you give in lines 8 through 13, you identify three different categories of benefits of grid-related distributed solar generation. Grid-connected. And you refer to grid-related benefits, general environmental benefits, and societal benefits. Those three categories of benefits that you believe are should be calculated.
I see that in my testimony, yes.
And then with respect to the grid-related benefits, on the same page, line 17 through the next page, page 12, line 3, you discuss issues like avoided energy costs, avoided capacity costs for generation, avoided and deferred capacity costs for transmission, fuel price hedging, and energy market impacts. And you believe that those are grid-related benefits that should be attributed to distributed solar. Is that correct?
I believe, depending on the analysis, those could be, yes.
And are you aware that this commission has previously rejected approval of those specific benefits?
In which context?
In the avoided cost qualifying facilities context.
Yes, I am.
And continuing on in the general environmental benefits, you talk about zero associated air or water emissions and allowing a utility to avoid environmental related costs. And you believe that those are general environmental benefits that should be attributed to solar.
Again, it depends. I would say if, for example, if the utility retained the RECs, that could be considered a benefit to the utility.
And if the utility did not retain the RECs?
It would depend.
Okay. And then for the societal benefits, you believe that issues or that, that the societal values of distributed solar should include things like job creation and the attraction of investment capital. That's your testimony?
I believe I listed some that could be.
And then you actually assert that the societal value is, quote, a necessarily broad category and could account for all of the benefits that are enjoyed by the public at large.
I would agree with that.
So that's a pretty broad.
Yes.
And then you turn the page, if you would. And when it comes to the costs to be associated with a net metering program, your question that begins on line 7, your answer is that the costs, quote, should be those costs that are directly attributable to the net metering program. That would be the...
Yes, I do say that.
So when it comes to some costs, let's hypothetically, if distributed solar residential grew to the point where the company could offset a coal-fired generation facility, would those jobs lost at the coal-fired generation facility be a cost that would be attributed to solar distributed PV?
I believe it would be difficult to directly attribute it to solar. I believe jobs lost at the closing of a coal plant would, of course, be jobs lost and a negative impact. But I would preface that with, if it were directly attributable, I could agree with that.
So if the production from the coal-fired plant, let's say at Huntington, Utah, was directly replaced by net metering generation, would you agree that those generation facility jobs lost would be costs assigned to the PV, to the net metering program?
My understanding, based on testimony that I've heard earlier today, is that there's a ways to go in terms of reduction in market purchases before a coal plant would be.
My question's a hypothetical.
Okay.
Would you agree that those are costs assigned to the net metering program?
Mr. Coleman, did you say could be or were? I think I missed a word there.
It's a hypothetical question. If the Huntington plant coal-fired generation capacity could be was offset due to net metering generation, would you assign those generation facility jobs lost as a cost to the net metering program under your definition of cost?
I believe that is one of very many potential factors that should go into a cost-benefit study. And hypothetically, among the many factors, it could be there.
So you would agree that would, under when you talk about being directly attributable, would you believe that that's directly attributable cost?
I would say if we're remaining in the realm of hypothetical,
yeah.
Directly attributable, sure. I mean, it seems logically to
okay.
follow.
And then with the understanding that the Huntington plant is a mine-mouth operation.
I'm sorry, say that again?
The Huntington plant in Emery County, Utah, is a mine-mouth operation. So if the Huntington generation plant shuts down, and you've agreed hypothetically that the generation facilities jobs are lost, if the mine operation shuts down because Huntington is a mine-mouth operation, would you agree that the mining jobs lost would be directly attributable to the...
That requires us to extend it to another hypothetical, because my understanding is that there's still a market for coal elsewhere.
Okay.
So, Mr. Coleman, I'm sorry. Is that the end of that one?
I have further questions on the issue.
Well, I think I'm going to object to any further hypotheticals beyond the power plant and the mine is next the shipping of the coal someplace else that might, the shipping jobs might be lost? I think we've reached the limit of any reasonable hypothetical, and I would object to any further questions along that line about potential job loss following out as far as you've gone.
I'm trying to better understand the definitional scopes, because as the societal values, he's categorized it as a necessarily broad category. So I'm trying to understand the corresponding scope and breadth of what is a cost as opposed to what is a benefit. And I think it's appropriate to explore particularly when he talks about under the societal benefits of job creation and attraction of investment capital, those things are, in my opinion, relatively attenuated. I'm trying to understand how far the equivalence goes on the cost side, and I think that's an appropriate line of questioning.
I think his answer was it depends on a whole bunch of other factors and other hypotheticals, and you seem to keep ignoring that and keep asking the same question with only one hypothetical, not listening to his response and asking your hypotheticals or allowing him to answer based on his response. His response, I think, is pretty clear, that your hypothetical depends on a whole bunch of other hypotheticals, which you haven't included.
I'll
raise the objection. That's fine. I mean, we've let you go to this point without objection.
It's overruled. Construct a hypothetical as you choose to, Mr. Coleman. I know you're trying to explore where the limit is.
Indeed.
And so let's see if we can get there relatively.
I'm doing my best.
Okay.
I can only.
Sure.
I can't compose the universe of hypotheticals, so I'm just trying to make one increment at a time. So in this case, with the mine mouth operation, if jobs are lost due to the closure of the generation facility, would those mining jobs lost be a cost under your scope of costs of assigned to a PV net metering program?
Can I ask Commissioner Clark a question?
Nobody gets to ask the commissioner's question. If you have an answer, Mr. Mixis,
okay.
We'd like to hear the answer.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure. I believe my answer hasn't changed. It's a long line of hypotheticals. At the end of any chain of hypotheticals, if you're asking for a yes or no, I would say you probably know the answer, logically. Sure.
Okay. At this point in time, I feel like I get to be the one who constructs the universe of hypotheticals. So we're gonna try and stick with mine. And I have just one more associated with the job creation, again, and attraction of investment capital. Understanding, and perhaps you don't, but the location of the Huntington operation in Emory County, would you attribute the hypothetical reduction in economic activity in that part of Emory County as a cost to the net metering program that resulted, the reduction in economic activity that results from the loss of generation facility jobs and the loss of a portion of the mining facility jobs, the resulting economic slowdown in that portion of Emory County, Utah, would you assign that as a cost to the solar net metering program?
I don't know if this is appropriate, but can I suggest that this line of questioning may be as relevant to utility scale solar as it is to net metering? And in that case, there may be precedent in other cases. I don't know if there have been, but this line of questioning seems to be referring to displacement of coal by any other resources.
You could suggest that, but I'm still going to ask you to answer my question.
I'll suggest that. And
do you have an answer to the question, or do you have the question in mind?
I would say, with the caveat that there's a long chain of hypotheticals, I would say that yes.
And when you come to the societal values, do you also believe that the same caveat of long life but line of hypotheticals involved in job creation and attraction investment capital may reduce the benefits that you would assign, such in to the same degree, the other side of the coin that you've been couching or limiting your answers to my cost questions? Would you believe the same limitations may apply on the benefit side?
Can you restate the question?
The answers to my cost questions, you've included a long line of additional hypotheticals in addition to the one that I've provided. Would you, in your societal values of distributed solar, you talk about job creation and attraction of investment capital as being benefits that should be assigned to net metering program. Would you also limit the scope of those benefits based upon this long line of similar type of hypotheticals?
I would suggest that there's been earlier discussion about what the effect on the distributed generation market of a NEM charge would be. I don't know that that's been settled, so I'm not sure that that's relevant.
Okay, well, you've hedged your answers by saying there's lots of other hypotheticals and lots of other variables that play into the costs and whether, for example, the mining jobs lost would be appropriately assigned as a cost. But you've included the idea of job creation as a benefit. Mm-hmm. Would you hedge that job creation value the same that you've hedged the job loss value? Is it the other side of the coin?
I understand what you're saying. I believe in this context and in my testimony, I wasn't trying to make a positive case for what a cost-benefit study should entail. Given that, I would accept an equivalent hedge, sure.
Okay, thank you. In your direct testimony, starting on page 20, you express some concern about the proportion of costs being assigned to the residential class.
Yes.
Can you explain to me the elements of or the methods involved with a cost of service study?
The elements involved in the cost of service study?
Have you ever conducted a cost of service study?
I have not, but I have somewhat familiarized myself with the cost of service study in this proceeding.
Have you ever, so with the answer to never have conducted a cost of service study, then I would presume that a follow-up question of that have you ever conducted a cost of service study on Rocky Mountain Power assets under the jurisdiction of this commission, that the answer would be no.
That's correct.
Are you aware that the Office of Consumer Services challenged the cost of service study presented by the company in this case?
I was not party to that part of the proceeding.
And I believe that you addressed this issue in your surrebuttal testimony, but you talked about your calculations of the appropriate cost to be assigned to the residential class based upon kilowatt hour sales as a back of the envelope calculation. Sorry. How far? As a back of the envelope calculation.
Yes, the back of the envelope calculation, I believe, stands because it says as a function of kilowatt hour sales.
Is that how costs are assigned in Utah?
No, and I believe I addressed that in my surrebuttal.
And one final point of discussion. In your testimony, you have a discussion of the analogous status of between a net metering customer and an energy efficiency customer.
Which part of my testimony are you referring to?
Well, that's probably a detail that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to pull out. So rebuttal testimony, thank you, page 7.
I'm there.
You're there?
Yep.
You have a discussion about what you call price discrimination, comparing energy efficiency customers with, or energy efficient customers with net metering customers.
Yes.
And there is some testimony or in positions presented that the average net metering customer continues to purchase from Rocky Mountain Power just a little over 500 kilowatt hours a month.
Witness stewards as 511. I had calculated 518.
Okay.
I'll go with hers.
Well, we'll go, if we can just go for ease of discussion, 500.
Sure.
In this discussion. So if an energy efficient customer consumes, has a 500 kilowatt purchase. Kilowatt hour purchase. Thank you. And a net metering customer has a net 500 kilowatt hour purchase. From your position is that those are that those customers are identical and this proposed charge is a discriminatory pricing.
My position, as I believe I explained in my testimony, is that there's another side to this, which is there are established factors in the cost of service study determining contribution to system peak, contribution to distribution system peak, and not contribution to non-coincident peak. And those factors should determine the cost responsibility of each individual customer. So I would say if an energy efficiency customer has a comparable reduction to a net metering customer in terms of those three factors, yes, they're similarly situated.
But from a gross standpoint, isn't it true that the net metering customer could have a larger transactional effect or transactional history over the company's system rather than the 500 kilowatt hour purchase?
Can I ask a clarifying question? When you say transactional, do you mean energy sales or do you mean exports?
Complete transaction scope. So export, import with credit redemption, and import with a retail purchase. So it's possible that a comparison of 500 kilowatt hour bills mm-hmm. is not a correct or a comprehensive representation of the actual use from a net metering customer over the system.
My understanding, if we exclude the consideration of exports, if we're only talking about offsetting on-site load, from the company's perspective, they are analogous. If you can also show data of their load curve and their peak load as it coincides with those three factors, distribution, system peak, system coincident peak, and non-coincident peak, and I believe I addressed this in my summary, but if those are the same and their net purchases from the company are the same, I would say yes, they are similarly situated, and charging a NEM charge is price discrimination.
So if a net metering customer has a net retail purchase of 500 kilowatt hours, the same as the energy efficiency customer, but the gross movement of electrons was higher because of exporting and importing activity.
I think I said excluding exports in this scenario.
In my scenario, if there's exporting and importing,
yeah,
and the net is 500, it looks like the energy efficient and the net metering customer use the system the same.
I believe there's not enough data because the meters, as I understand it, are read on a monthly basis. So exports at any particular time are, the data on exports at any particular time are not available.
But on a monthly basis at the cumulative billing
on a monthly basis, if the net metering customer is exporting, they have simply exported more than they imported in that month. There's no way they're comparable to the energy efficiency customer unless the energy efficiency customer somehow has on-site generation to export and consumes nothing.
Okay, let me try and this one more time. And if I fail, then we'll be done. energy efficiency customer has a retail complete purchase of 500 because of energy efficiency issues. If the net metering customer at the end of the billing cycle also has a 500 kilowatt retail bill, that doesn't necessarily mean
kilowatt hour,
thank you, doesn't necessarily mean that the usage between those two customers is identical, even though their bills are identical, correct?
I'm sorry, just rephrase your question. You're saying they are not or not?
The fact that both bills say 500 kilowatt hours,
yes,
doesn't necessarily mean that both customers had the same usage level. The energy efficiency customer used 500 kilowatt hours. The net metering customer, due to the opportunity at the billing mathematical process at the end of the cycle of being able to cash in some credits, that resulted in a 500 net bill. But it's possible, is it not, that that net metering customer had more usage than 500 kilowatts, more usage than the energy kilowatt hours, more usage than the energy efficiency customer?
Again, what is missing here is their contribution to use of the system at particular times during the day and during the month by which cost of service methods allocate responsibility for fixed costs.
But their total use, although it looks the same, could have been different.
Absent the data, it's impossible to prove one way or the other.
It's possible that it could have happened.
Again, without the data, you can't prove one way or the other.
Is it possible?
Is it possible that they have
that the net metering customer's bill of 500 kilowatt hours,
yeah,
is not representative of the total use value because of the potential to cash in credits?
Okay, so now you're talking about cashing in credits earned in a previous month?
Yes.
So you're saying after cashing in the credits, they would have a 500 kilowatt hour net consumption? Yeah,
their bill from the company is 500 kilowatt hours, right, exactly the same number as the energy efficiency customer.
Right.
But the fact is, it's possible that their actual usage levels are different.
First of all, I would say, speaking of kilowatt hour consumption, misses the entire picture of those responsibility for distribution and transmission and generation fixed costs. I'll concede it's possible.
I have no further questions.
Mr. Rossetti.
No questions, thank you.
No,
Ms. Roberts.
Club.
Ms. Hayes. Redirect.
Just one question, Mr. Mixis. In light of that very lengthy series of hypotheticals about jobs and jobs lost and gained, could you explain the relative number of jobs that would be involved with producing enough energy from solar, as Mr. Coleman laid out, to displace the power plant versus the employment at the power plant, for example?
No.
Okay. Nothing further. Thanks.
Questions? Thank you, Mr. Mixis. You're excused. We'll be in recess until 20 till the hour, and at which time we'll hear from Dr. Mulvaney, I believe. Thank you.
I appreciate the legal aid. You don't know how many times I've been asked questions on the stand and wish they had a whiteboard. And you could go over and draw a graph or something to explain what you're misunderstanding.
I won't come up here, John.